Imagine for a second that you could like legally wipe $450,000 of taxable gains completely out of existence.
Just vaporize it.
Yeah, totally vaporize a massive tax bill.
Yeah.
And you don't even need, you know, a shady offshore account or some team of Cayman Island lawyers to do it. All it takes is a single heartbeat.
Or, well, the stopping of one.
Right. Exactly. The stopping of one heartbeat. And that is this wild sort of structural mechanism buried right inside the U.S. tax code. We are going to uncover exactly how that works today. But hey, before we get into it, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. Look, we know exam prep can be a total grind, but they've got a full Series 66 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It actually learns where you're weak and drills those concepts. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Yeah, that vanishing tax trick we mentioned, it's honestly, probably one of the most powerful wealth transfer tools in human history.
And entirely legal, right?
Entirely legal. It just requires understanding the underlying machinery.
Which is exactly our mission today. We are taking a massive deep dive into the taxation unit for your Series 66 exam prep.
Huh.
But I want to set some ground rules for you, the listener, right now. If you have ADHD like me, or if you just hate reading dry textbooks, sitting and staring at flashcards about tax rates is just...
It's a surefire way to fall asleep.
Right, it is. And the exam writers, they know people just memorize rules. So they will twist a scenario by 2 degrees on the test, and if you only memorize the surface-level flashcard, you will absolutely fail the question.
Yeah, we are not doing that. We are going to deeply understand the why. Because the tax code, you know, it's not just a spreadsheet.
No, it's totally behavioral.
Exactly. It's a behavioral document. It is literally 100 years of the government trying to incentivize certain behaviors, like investing for the long term or funding a business, and trying to punish other behaviors, like creating fake losses just to game the system.
So once you grasp those boundaries, the exam questions kind of answer themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And to keep us locked in, we are going to use a recurring cast of characters to really bring these dry rules to life.
Yeah.
First up is Disastrous Dave.
Oh, Dave.
Yeah, Dave is that client who perfectly mistimes every single trade. He buys high, sells low, acts on impulse, and just completely ignores the tax code until his accountant screams at him in April.
Which, by the way, every practice has at least one Dave. He is basically the ultimate stress test for a financial advisor.
Totally. Second, we have Frank, the founder. Frank is Dave's buddy. He's this serial entrepreneur who is constantly launching absurd, highly niche businesses like artisanal glow-in-the-dark shoelaces, and he never has any idea how to legally structure them.
Frank is going to be super helpful for mapping out the entire business entity landscape later on.
Right. And finally, we have Aunt Agatha. She is Dave's obscenely wealthy, somewhat eccentric older relative.
Mm.
She is just sitting on a dragon hoard of assets, watching Dave make a total mess of his life, and she is desperately trying to figure out how to protect him from himself.
And how to pass on her wealth without the IRS taking half of it.
Exactly. The perfect trio to run through the entire life cycle of taxation. And listener, I'm going to be talking to you directly today. We are going to flag every single trap the exam writers use to catch you.
You're in the hot seat.
You really are.
Yeah.
I will pause and ask you to solve these problems as we go. So let's kick this off with Dave. Before Frank starts his weird companies or Agatha sets up her trusts, we need to understand how the IRS treats basic individual trading.
Right.
So Disastrous Dave decides he's going to be a day trader. He funds a brokerage account. What is the fundamental, like, foundational concept he needs to understand before he even clicks buy?
He needs to understand cost basis. Yeah. I know it sounds incredibly basic, but it is the bedrock of everything. Your cost basis is essentially the capital you have already paid taxes on.
Okay, so the seed money.
Exactly. When Dave earns a salary at his day job, he pays income tax on it. The money left over, his after-tax cash, is what he uses to buy a stock. Let's say he buys one share of a company for $100. His cost basis is $100.
The IRS looks at that and says, cool, we already taxed that $100.
Right. We won't tax it again. That $100 is protected.
I like that. Protected seed money. It's the baseline.
It's a great way to put it. Now, say Dave holds that stock, and a year later, it's worth $150. He sells it. He doesn't pay tax on the full $150, right? Because $100 of it is his protected seed money.
He only pays tax on the $50 of new wealth he created.
Exactly. That $50 is his capital gain. And conversely, if the stock dropped to $80 and he sold it, he has a $20 capital loss.
Okay, so a gain is when you sell above basis. A loss is below basis. That's simple enough. But the IRS treats these gains very differently based on, like, a ticking clock, right?
Yeah, the holding period. This is where those behavioral incentives we talked about kick in. The IRS divides the world into short-term and long-term.
Okay, break that down.
So if Dave holds an asset for 12 months or less and sells it at a profit, that is a short-term capital gain. The government looks at that behavior and says, you aren't really investing in this company. You are just speculating. You're trading.
And the IRS absolutely hates speculators.
They do not want to encourage it because massive rapid buying and selling creates huge market volatility. So short-term capital gains do not get any special tax treatment at all. They are taxed at Dave's ordinary income tax rate.
Which means if Dave is a high earner at his day job, that short-term gain could be taxed at the maximum federal bracket.
Right, which goes all the way up to 37%.
Ouch. But what if Dave can actually manage to sit on his hands for a bit?
If he holds the asset for more than 12 months, meaning a year and a day, minimum, it becomes a long-term capital gain. Now, the government says, thank you, Dave. You provided stable long-term capital to a business.
You helped stabilize the financial markets.
Exactly. And to reward that specific behavior, they unlock preferential tax rates. Depending on Dave's overall income, his long-term capital gains rate will drop to 0%, 15%, or a maximum of 20%.
I mean, that is just a staggering difference. You are talking about potentially dropping your tax burden from 37% down to 20% or even 15%, literally just for waiting one extra day to click the sell button.
Which is exactly why financial advisors spend so much time managing holding periods for clients. Selling on day 365 versus day 366 can literally cost a client thousands of dollars in unnecessary taxes.
Okay, but let me throw a wrench into this. We're talking about Dave here. Dave is disastrous. He rarely has gains. He is mostly just generating huge losses.
Fair point.
So let's talk about the mechanics of capital losses, because there is a very specific order of operations the exam expects you to know.
Right. When tax time comes, you have to net your gains and losses against each other. The rule is that you first match like with like.
Match like with like. Got it.
So you take all your short-term losses for the year and use them to offset your short-term gains. Then you take all your long-term losses and offset your long-term gains.
I always picture it like two separate buckets. You clean out the short-term bucket first, and then you clean out the long-term bucket.
That's a good visual. And then if you have a net loss in one bucket and a net gain in the other, then you can cross the streams and offset them against each other.
Okay.
And at the end of all this math, you are left with one final number for the year. It's either a net capital gain, which you obviously pay taxes on, or a net capital loss.
And here is where we hit one of the most heavily tested rules on the Series 66, the $3,000 limit. Listener, I am putting you in the hot seat right now. I am going to give you a scenario. I want you to think about how you would solve this before I reason it out.
Let's hear it.
Okay, Dave has a terrible year trading tech stocks. He generates $50,000 in capital losses. But earlier in the year, he had a brief moment of success and made $45,000 in capital gains flipping a real estate investment trust.
Okay, so $50,000 in losses, $45,000 in gains.
Right, so Dave does the netting process. He takes his $50,000 in losses, offsets his $45,000 in gains, which completely wipes out the gains. He is left with a final net capital loss of $5,000 for the year.
A pretty typical Dave year.
Exactly. Now, Dave also has a regular W-2 day job making a normal salary. Mm-hmm. Here's my question for you, listener. How much of that $5,000 net capital loss can Dave deduct from his regular salary this year to lower his income tax? Think about the limit. Take a beat.
It's a trippy one if you don't know the rule.
Okay, let's work this out. Dave wants to deduct the full $5,000, but the IRS says, no, you are capped. The maximum allowable deduction against ordinary income is $3,000 per year.
Right. If you are single or married filing jointly, it is $3,000. If you are married but filing separately, they actually cut it in half to $1,500. But in Dave's case, he's single, so he can only deduct $3,000 from his salary.
Which begs the question, what happens to the remaining $2,000 of his loss? Does it just, like, vanish into the ether?
No, the IRS is not quite that cruel. The remaining $2,000 becomes a carry-forward loss. It just carries forward into the next tax year indefinitely.
So on January 1st, he just wakes up with it.
Exactly. On January 1st of the next year, Dave wakes up and he already has a $2,000 capital loss sitting in his account, ready to offset any gains he might make in the new year. And if he doesn't make any gains next year, he can just deduct that $2,000 against his salary next year because it's under the $3,000 limit.
Let me push back on the philosophy here, though. Why does that $3,000 cap exist at all? I mean, if I lost 50 grand, I lost 50 grand. It's my money. Why won't the IRS let me deduct the full net loss from my salary?
Because the IRS needs to protect the national tax base.
Protect the base.
Think about a high-powered CEO making $10 million a year in W-2 salary. If there are no limit on capital loss deductions, that CEO could intentionally make terrible high-risk bets in the stock market, lose $10 million, and use that investment loss to completely wipe out the income tax on their salary.
Oh, wow. Yeah. The government would collect zero income tax from a massive earner.
Right. So the IRS puts a firewall between your investment gambling and your ordinary wages. They cap it at $3,000 so that you cannot use Wall Street losses to dodge your Main Street income taxes.
That makes perfect sense. The firewall protects the W-2 revenue. Okay, so Dave understands the $3,000 rule now, but he gets another brilliant idea.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. He realizes he is holding a stock that is absolutely tanked. He bought it at $100. It's currently trading at $40. He has a $60 unrealized loss. He wants to sell it to harvest that tax loss so he can use it to offset some gains.
Sounds like a standard tax loss harvesting strategy.
Sure, but Dave really loves the company. He thinks they're going to announce a new product next week and the stock will rocket back up. So Dave's master plan, he sells stock on Tuesday afternoon to lock in the tax loss. And then he logs in on Wednesday morning and buys the exact same stock right back.
Oh, Dave. He just ran face first into the wash sale rule.
The dreaded wash sale.
Yeah.
The absolute bane of all day traders. Let's break down the mechanics of this.
So the IRS hates fake transactions. People call this tax loss harvesting. But if you buy the exact same asset right back the next day, you haven't actually changed your economic position.
Right. You still own the company.
You still have the same exposure. You just manufactured a paper loss to lower your tax bill. The IRS will not allow that. The wash sale rule states that if you sell a security at a loss and you buy a substantially identical security within 30 days before or 30 days after the sale, the loss is disallowed.
Let me emphasize that window for you, listener, because the exam will try to trick you on the math here. It is 30 days before the trade, plus the day of the trade itself, plus 30 days after the trade. That creates a 61-day window where you cannot touch that stock or anything substantially identical to it.
The before part is what usually confuses people.
Yeah. Why 30 days before?
Imagine Dave bought 100 shares of a stock in January. In November, it's way down. To try and get around the rule, on November 1st, he buys a second batch of 100 shares. Then on November 15th, he sells the original January shares at a loss.
Thinking he's clever.
Right. He thinks, I didn't buy it after I sold. I bought it before. But the IRS says, nice try. You acquired replacement shares within 30 days prior to generating the loss. That is still a wash sale.
Okay, so Dave triggers the wash sale. He bought it back the next day. The loss is disallowed. Does that mean the tax benefit is just like permanently destroyed?
In a standard taxable brokerage account, no. It is not destroyed. It is just deferred. The IRS takes that disallowed loss and adds it to the cost basis of the new replacement shares Dave just bought.
Walk me through the math on that so I can really visualize it.
Let's use Dave's numbers. He bought at 100, he sells at 40, he has a $60 loss, he buys it back the next day for 40. Because it's a wash sale, he cannot claim the $60 loss on his taxes this year.
Right.
Instead, the IRS forces him to take that $60 disallowed loss and add it to the $40 cost basis of his new shares. His new adjusted cost basis becomes $100.
Oh, so he is right back where he started for tax purposes.
Exactly. When he eventually sells those new shares years down the road, assuming he doesn't trigger another wash sale, he will finally get to realize the economic reality of that investment. The tax benefit is just kicked down the road.
All right, listener, pattern interrupt time. Warning, exam trap. We just established that a wash sale in a regular account just defers the loss by adjusting your basis. But the Series 66 writers have a sadistic favorite scenario involving retirement accounts.
They love testing this.
So let's say Dave sells his losing stock in his regular Robinhood taxable account. He knows the rule now. He knows he has to wait 31 days to buy it back. But on day 15, he is panicking. He thinks the stock is going to moon. He doesn't want to buy it in his Robinhood account and trigger the wash sale. So he logs into his completely separate traditional IRA and he buys the replacement stock inside the IRA. does he outsmart the IRS?
Not even close. The IRS explicitly states that buying a substantially identical security in your IRA or your spouse's IRA triggers the wash sale rule on the loss in your taxable account. All your accounts are viewed together for this rule.
But here is the brutal part, listener, and I need you to think about this mechanism. What happens to the disallowed loss? In a normal account, we add it to the basis of the new shares. Can we do that in an IRA?
We cannot. And this is the real trap. You have to understand why you can't. A traditional IRA does not track capital gains or cost basis in the same way a taxable account does.
Right, because it's all pre-tax.
Exactly. When you eventually pull money out of a traditional IRA in retirement, every single dollar is taxed as ordinary income. There is no concept of a capital loss inside a traditional IRA that you can deduct on your tax return.
So if Dave generates a wash sale by buying the replacement shares in his IRA, the loss from his taxable account has absolutely nowhere to go. It can't attach to the IRA shares in any useful way.
It can't. Because the IRA cannot utilize a capital loss basis adjustment, that tax loss from the Robinhood account is permanently disallowed. It is gone forever, vaporized. Dave lost the money in real life, and he will never, ever get a tax deduction for it.
So, listener, if you see a question where a wash sale involves repurchasing shares inside an IRA, the answer is permanently disallowed. Do not pick. Adjust the basis. That is a huge trap for the unwary.
Just don't mix your taxable accounts and your IRAs like that.
Let's look at one more individual topic for Dave before we move to the business side. Dividends. Dave is totally tired of losing money on growth stocks, so he buys a massive, boring, blue-chip utility company because he just wants those reliable quarterly dividend checks.
He is shifting from capital appreciation to income generation, which is fine, but he needs to know that not all dividends are treated the same by the tax code. He needs to deeply understand the difference between qualified dividends and ordinary dividends.
Let's define ordinary dividends first, because that sounds like, well, the default.
It is the default. Okay. An ordinary dividend, also known as a non-qualified dividend, is taxed exactly like it sounds as ordinary income. It gets lumped in with Dave's W-2 salary and taxed at his marginal tax bracket, which again could be up to 37%.
But Dave wants qualified dividends. What actually makes a dividend qualified?
If a dividend is qualified, it gets taxed at the exact same preferential rates as long-term capital gains, that 0, 15, or 20% rate.
So a massive tax discount on the income generated by the stock.
Massive. But to get this, the stock must be issued by a U.S. corporation or a qualified foreign corporation, and this is the critical part. Dave must meet a specific holding period requirement.
Let's unpack the holding period. This is where I always use an analogy. I think of a qualified dividend like a loyalty program for stock owners. Imagine the company is throwing a party on a specific date, and they are handing out VIP gift bags. The gift bag is the lower tax rate. Now, the company has to draw a line in the sand to figure out who actually gets an invitation to this party.
Right. And in finance, that line in the sand is called the ex-dividend date.
Let's explain the ex-dividend date like I'm five. What is it mechanically?
When a company declares a dividend, they set a record date. They say, whoever is officially on our record books on Friday will get the dividend.
Right.
But because it takes one business day for stock trades to settle and the paperwork to clear, the stock exchange sets the ex-dividend date one business day before the record date. If you buy the stock on the ex-dividend date or after, you are buying it ex-meaning without the dividend.
So the person who sold it to you gets to keep the dividend because they will still be on the record books when the music stops.
Exactly.
Okay, so to get the dividend at all, Dave has to buy the stock before the ex-dividend date. But just getting the dividend doesn't make it a qualified dividend.
No, it doesn't. Going back to your loyalty program analogy, the IRS does not want people showing up 5 minutes before the party starts, grabbing the VIP gift bag and immediately leaving.
They don't want people buying a stock the day before the ex-dividend date, collecting the cash and dumping the stock the next day while claiming a 15% tax rate.
They want commitment. To make the dividend qualified, Dave must hold the stock for more than 60 days during a specific 121-day window. And that window begins 60 days before the ex-dividend date.
So it's 60 days before plus the ex-dividend date itself plus 60 days after. That's the 121-day window. And Dave just has to prove he held the stock for at least 61 of those days.
If he does, he proves he's a loyal investor and the dividend becomes qualified.
That's the mechanism. And listener, the exam writers love to test this by trying to confuse your timelines. Here is the classic exam trap. They will give you a scenario where Dave buys a stock, holds it for 45 days, collects a dividend during that time, and then decides to hold the stock for 2 full years before finally selling it. They will ask you, How is that dividend from day 45 taxed?
Let them think about that for a second.
Let me reason this out. He held the stock for 2 years. 2 years is a long-term capital gain. So my brain automatically wants to say the dividend is qualified because he was a long-term investor.
But that is wrong, and that is exactly what they want you to think.
Ah. The capital gains holding period, 1 year plus a day, is a completely separate bucket from the 60-day dividend holding period. You cannot mix them.
No, you can't. When Dave collected that dividend, the 121-day window opened and closed. During that specific window, did he hold it for more than 60 days?
No, he only held it for 45 days before the window shut.
Exactly. It does not matter that he eventually held it for 2 years. At the time the dividend was evaluated, it failed the loyalty test. That dividend will forever be taxed as ordinary income.
Wow. Keep the capital gains clock and the dividend clock completely separate in your mind, listener. Like Dave has realized he's a terrible trader. He keeps triggering wash sales. He's messing up his dividend windows. He is just losing money. He decides to take his remaining cash and give it to his buddy, Frank, the founder.
Which transitions us perfectly into part two, the businesses.
Frank is going to take Dave's capital and start his new venture, manufacturing artisanal glow-in-the-dark shoelaces. A true visionary.
Obviously.
But Frank has a problem. He has the seed money, he has the glowing thread, but he needs to pick a legal business entity. And this is a massive, heavily weighted topic on the Series 66. How does the entity you choose dictate your tax reality? Let's start with the oldest, most traditional structure, the C corporation.
So a C corporation is a separate, distinct legal entity. This is vital to understand. In the eyes of the IRS, a C corporation is basically an artificial person.
Like a real person.
Right. It can sue, it can be sued, and most importantly, it files its own tax return and it pays its own taxes at the corporate level.
And what is the corporate tax rate right now?
Currently, it is a flat 21% corporate tax rate.
Okay, let's walk through the math on that. Frank's shoelace company has a great first year. They make $100,000 in pure profit. Because it is a C corporation, the artificial person has to file a tax return. The corporation pays 21%, so $21,000 goes to the IRS.
Yep.
There's $79,000 left sitting in the corporate bank account. Now, Frank wants to take that money home to pay his mortgage and buy groceries. He takes the $79,000 out of the business. What happens?
The corporation distributes that $79,000 to Frank legally as a dividend. Now, Frank, the human being, has to file his personal tax return. He reports that he received $79,000 in dividend income from the corporation, and he has to pay personal income tax on that money.
This is the infamous double taxation.
Exactly. The exact same dollar of profit was taxed once when the corporation earned it and taxed a second time when the owner received it.
Let me use an analogy here. I used to think of this like two guys renting apartments, but that's wrong. The best way to visualize double taxation is a toll road.
Okay, I like that.
The profit is a car. To get the car off the highway of commerce and into the business's garage, it has to pass through a toll booth. The C-Corp pays the 21% toll. Now the car is in the garage.
Safe and sound.
But Frank wants to drive the car from the business garage to his personal house. To do that, he has to drive through a second toll booth on the driveway. The exact same car pays a toll twice.
That is a much more accurate metaphor. The IRS collects twice on the exact same stream of economic profit.
Here is the massive shortcut for the exam, listener. If a question ever asks you, why would a business owner prefer an S-Corp or an LLC over a C-Corp? What is the answer? It is always to avoid double taxation.
Always.
Double taxation is the defining neon flashing disadvantage of a C-Corporation.
So naturally, Frank looks at that toll road and says, I hate double taxation. I want to structure my business as a pass-through entity.
Let's define the pass-through universe. We are talking about S-Corp, partnerships, and LLCs. What is the fundamental mechanics of a pass-through?
The core concept is that the business entity itself does not pay federal income tax. The corporate toll booth is totally removed. Instead, all the profits and all the losses flow directly through the business and land squarely on the personal tax returns of the owners.
So Frank avoids the 21% corporate tax entirely.
Yes. Now, the business itself still has to file an informational return with the IRS, like a Form 1065 if it's a partnership. But this return doesn't include a check.
It's just paperwork.
It is just a map. It tells the IRS, hey, we made $100,000 this year, and here is exactly how we carved it up among the owners.
And how do the owners actually report it?
The business generates a document called a Schedule K-1 for each owner. If Frank owns 50% and Dave owns 50%, they each get a K-1 showing $50,000 of profit. Frank takes his K-1, plugs it into his personal form 1040, and pays his individual tax rate on it. Only one toll booth.
Before we go deeper into the taxation of pass-throughs, we need to do a structural check because the exam loves testing the limits of these entities. You can't just arbitrarily choose to be an S-corp if you are some massive global enterprise, right?
Correct. An S-corporation is highly restricted by the IRS. The government is willing to give up the corporate tax, but only for small domestic operations.
What are the limits?
An S-corp is limited to a maximum of 100 shareholders. Furthermore, those shareholders generally must be U.S. citizens or resident aliens. You cannot have a foreign corporation or a massive partnership owning shares in an S-corp.
And there's a restriction on the stock itself, too.
Yes, an S-corp can only have one class of stock, usually common stock. You cannot have a complex capital structure with preferred shares that get paid out first and common shares that get the scraps. Everyone is on completely equal footing regarding distributions.
What about a partnership? How does that compare structurally?
Partnerships are vastly more flexible. You can have an unlimited number of partners. You can have general partners who run the day-to-day and take on the liability, and limited partners who just provide capital and sit back.
You can even have corporations as partners, right?
Absolutely. It is the go-to structure for complex multi-party ventures.
Okay, now we have to talk about the LLC, the limited liability company. Frank hears this is the most popular entity for startups, so he wants to form one. But listener, here is the trick question. What is the federal tax rate for an LLC?
Oh, this is a good one.
It is a trick question because an LLC does not have a federal tax classification. Let me explain that because it blows people's minds when they first study this. An LLC is a legal structure created by the state government to protect your personal assets from business lawsuits. It is a state-level shield. The IRS, which is federal, looks at an LLC and says, we don't know what this is. We don't have an LLC tax bracket.
Exactly. An LLC is a chameleon for tax purposes. Its taxation depends entirely on what the owners elect to be treated as.
So how does the IRS classify them by default if they don't make a choice?
If it is a single member LLC, just Frank owning it 100%, the IRS defaults to calling it a disregarded entity. They just treat it exactly like a sole proprietorship. Frank files a Schedule C on his personal return.
And if there's more than one owner?
If it is a multi-member LLC like Frank and Dave, the IRS defaults to taxing it as a partnership.
But the LLC has a superpower. They can file a form, often called check-the-box regulations, and tell the IRS, actually, we want to be taxed as a C corporation or an S corporation.
Yes. They can keep the legal protection of the LLC at the state level, but elect the tax machinery of a corporation at the federal level.
So, listener, if an exam question asks you a highly specific tax question about an LLC, and they don't tell you what the LLC elected to be taxed as, you usually cannot answer the question. LLC alone does not define the tax reality.
It's just a state shield.
Okay, let's dive into the most dangerous tax mechanism for pass-through entities. I want to put the listener back in the hot seat. Listen to this scenario involving what I call the phantom income trap.
This is brutal.
It really is. Frank sets up Frank Shoelaces as an S corporation. He and Dave are 50-50 owners. The company has a monster year. They make $200,000 in pure bottom line profit. But Frank is a visionary. He looks at Dave and says, Dave, we are not taking a dime of this out of the business. We are reinvesting every single penny into buying a massive warehouse of new glowing thread. We are going to scale.
Typical Frank.
So the business bank account keeps the 200K. They distribute absolutely zero cash to Frank and Dave personally. Here's the question, listener. Come tax time, does Frank owe personal income taxes on his $100,000 share of the profits, even though that money never hit his personal bank account?
Think about the mechanism of a pass-through.
Let's trace the logic. The business made profit. The business doesn't pay tax. Somebody has to pay tax.
Yes, Frank and Dave absolutely owe taxes on that money. This is the exact definition of phantom income. In a pass-through entity, the income is taxable to the owners in the year it is earned by the business, whether or not it is actually distributed as cash.
I need to really emphasize the pain of this. Frank has a K-1 that says he made $100,000. The IRS says, great, you owe us $24,000 in taxes. Frank looks at his personal checking account, and he has $0 from the business because it was all reinvested in thread. How does Frank pay the IRS?
He has to pull it from his personal savings. He might have to sell personal stock or take out a loan or use money from a spouse's day job. He has a massive tax liability and absolutely no matching cash flow from the asset that generated it.
That feels so incredibly unfair to a new business owner. Why does the IRS operate this way?
Look at it from the IRS's perspective. The S-Corp pays no tax. If the IRS allowed Frank to leave the profit inside the business without taxing it at the personal level, that money would exist completely untaxed.
Businesses would just hoard profits for decades to avoid taxation.
Exactly. The IRS says you earned economic profit this year, you pay taxes this year. What you choose to do with the cash, whether you put it in your pocket or buy more thread, is a management decision. But the tax bill is due. The K-1 dictates the tax liability, not the cash distribution.
The K-1 dictates the tax liability, not the cash in your pocket. That is a fundamental law of finance. Let's transition from Frank's startup to passive investments. Clients love yield. They love assets that spit out regular cash.
They do.
And the Series 66 loves to test two specific high-yield vehicles against each other because they sound similar, but their tax engines are fundamentally different. I want to do a deep dive side-by-side comparison of REITs real estate investment trusts and MLPs master limited partnerships.
This is a classic exam showdown. They are both heavily marketed to retail investors as income-producing assets, but if you put them in a taxable brokerage account, they behave completely differently.
Let's start with the REIT. We know it holds commercial real estate, shopping malls, apartment buildings. How is a REIT structured legally?
Legally, a REIT is a corporation. And because you are investing in a corporation, you are considered a shareholder. At the end of the year, to report your income, you receive a standard form 1099, just like you would for owning shares of Apple or Microsoft. The payout you receive is legally classified as a dividend.
Okay, stop right there. My brain immediately hears the word dividend, and I remember our earlier conversation. Dividends from U.S. corporations can be qualified dividends, which means they get the VIP gift bag, the 15% preferential tax rate. Does a REIT dividend get that preferential rate?
No, it absolutely does not.
Okay, why?
And this is the trap the exam writers set for you. A REIT dividend is taxed as ordinary income at your highest marginal bracket.
But wait, why? If it's a U.S. corporation paying a dividend, why doesn't it qualify for the lower rate? Let's connect the dots here.
To understand why, you have to look at how a REIT avoids the corporate tax. Normally, a corporation pays 21% on its profits, but the tax code gives REITs a special deal. If a REIT distributes at least 90% of its taxable income to its shareholders every year, the REIT itself owes zero corporate tax. It wipes out the corporate toll booth.
Oh, I see.
But remember, the IRS always gets their toll eventually. Because the REIT didn't pay any corporate tax on that money, the IRS refuses to give the shareholder a discount. They say, this money hasn't been taxed yet, so when it hits Dave's hands, Dave has to pay the full ordinary income tax rate on it.
That makes perfect sense when you trace the dollar. The VIP qualified rate is a discount given because the corporation already paid a 21% tax. Mm. Since the REIT paid zero, Dave gets zero discount. REIT dividends equal ordinary income. Now contrast that with the MLP, the Master Limited Partnership. These usually operate in the energy sector, like oil and gas pipelines.
Right. An MLP is a true pass-through entity. It is a partnership that happens to trade publicly on an exchange. Because it is a partnership, you are not a shareholder. You are a limited partner. You do not get a 1099 at tax time. You get a Schedule K-1.
And the payouts you receive, the quarterly cash you get, are they dividends?
No. Legally, they are called distributions. And their tax treatment is the kicker. MLP cash distributions are generally not taxed as income when you receive them. Instead, they are treated as a return of capital.
Explain the mechanism of your return of capital. Why isn't it taxable income?
When Dave buys a unit of an MLP for $100, he is investing capital into the partnership. When the MLP hands him a $5 cash distribution, the tax code largely views that not as a slice of new taxable profit, but as the partnership literally handing Dave back $5 of his original $100 seed money.
Since it is his own money being returned to him, it's not taxable income.
Exactly.
But it must affect his basis, right?
Yes. The consequence is that Dave's cost basis in the MLP must be reduced by that $5. His new basis is $95. Every time he gets a distribution, his basis drops lower and lower. When he eventually sells the MLP years later, his basis might be close to zero, which means he will have a massive capital gain at that point.
So an MLP just defers the tax liability by constantly shrinking your cost basis. Let's summarize that side by side because it is a guaranteed point on the exam. REIT, it is a corporation. You are a shareholder. You get a 1099. The payout is an ordinary income dividend. MLP, it is a pass-through. You are a partner. You get a K-1. The payout is a distribution that reduces your cost basis. And listener, don't forget, because an MLP is a pass-through that issues a K-1, the phantom income trap applies. Dave might get a K-1 showing taxable income from the pipe farm operations, even if his cash distribution was entirely treated as a return of capital.
It is a tangled web, but if you map the entity to the tax form, you can navigate it.
All right, we are moving to part three, the untouchables. Let's check in on Aunt Agatha. She's watching disastrous Dave lose money day trading, and she's watching Frank force Dave to pay phantom taxes on shoelace thread. She's getting deeply concerned about Dave's financial incompetence.
Very concerned.
She knows that if she just hands Dave $1 million, he will blow it on meme stocks. So she decides she needs to lock away some money for Dave in a trust. Let's talk about trust and estate taxation.
A trust is a fascinating legal structure. It is a fiduciary arrangement where a third party, the trustee, holds assets on behalf of a beneficiary, like Dave. But for our purposes, you have to understand that a trust is a separate tax-paying entity. Just like a C corporation, it is an artificial person. It files its own tax return, which is Form 1041.
Okay.
But the tax brackets applied to trusts are completely unique. They're incredibly aggressively compressed.
Let's define compressed with real numbers so the listener understands the severity here.
Let's look at the tax year 2026. If you are a married couple filing jointly, you don't hit the maximum 37% federal tax bracket until you have over $768,000 of taxable income. You have to be making serious top 1% money to pay the top rate as a human being.
Right, you have a massive runway before you hit 37%. What about a trust?
A trust hits that exact same maximum 707% tax rate at just over $16,000 of retained income.
$16,000.
$16,000.
That is absolutely nothing. If the trust holds a decent portfolio of dividend stocks, it will generate $16,000 in a few months. And any dollar over that is taxed at the highest possible rate in America.
Yes. The slope is basically a cliff.
Why? Why is the IRS so unbelievably punitive to trusts? I thought trusts were standard estate planning tools.
They are, but you have to look at the history. Before the IRS compressed these brackets, wealthy people would use trusts as tax shelters. If Aunt Agatha was in the 37% bracket personally, and she had an extra $1 million generating $50,000 in interest, she didn't want to pay 37% on that interest.
Naturally.
So she would create a trust, put $1 million in it, and let the trust earn the $50,000. Back then, trusts had normal tax brackets, so the trust would only pay maybe 10 or 15% on that income. Some wealthy families would set up 50 different trusts, splitting their assets among them to ensure the income stayed in the lowest possible brackets.
So they were atomizing their wealth to dodge the progressive tax system?
Exactly. So Congress and the IRS fought back. They compressed the brackets so severely that retaining income inside a trust is now a terrible tax strategy. The message from the IRS is clear. Do not use trusts to hide income from higher brackets.
Okay, so if Agatha puts money in a trust for Dave and the trust earns $20,000 in dividends, it is getting crushed by taxes. What is the mechanical strategy to avoid this brutal 37% cliff?
The strategy is simple. Do not let the trust retain the income. The trustee will take that $20,000 of dividend income and distribute it directly to the beneficiary, Dave.
And how does that solve the tax problem?
When a trust distributes income to a beneficiary, the trust receives a tax deduction for that exact amount. So the trust's taxable income drops to zero. It owes no tax. The income flows out of the trust, generates a Schedule K-1 for Dave, and Dave must report that $20,000 on his personal tax return.
And since Dave is currently broke from his terrible day trading, his personal marginal tax rate is probably 12% or 22%?
Precisely. By distributing the income, the trustee shifts the tax burden off of the trust's compressed 37% cliff and onto Dave's much lower human tax bracket. It's a pass-through mechanism designed to force the income back into the individual tax pool.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, not all trusts act the same way. What are the specific types of trusts we need to categorize for the exam?
For income tax purposes, there are three main categories. Let's start with the grantor trust. In a grantor trust, the person who created the trust, the grantor and Agatha, retains a significant amount of control over the assets. Maybe she can revoke the trust or change the beneficiaries whenever she wants.
So she still has her hands on the steering wheel.
Right. And because she still has so much control, the IRS looks at it and says, nice try, Agatha, but this isn't really a separate entity. You basically still own this. In a grantor trust, the trust itself is essentially ignored for income tax purposes. All the income generated by the trust flows directly onto Aunt Agatha's personal Form 1040, and she pays the tax on it at her own rates.
Got it. Grantor trust equals tax to the creator. What about the others?
Then you have the distinction between a simple trust and a complex trust. This is highly testable. A simple trust is rigid. By definition, a simple trust must distribute all of its earned income annually to the beneficiaries. The trustee has no choice. If the trust makes 10 grand in interest, 10 grand gets sent out. Furthermore, a simple trust cannot distribute the underlying principal, the corpus, and it cannot make charitable contributions.
It's basically a mechanical funnel. Income comes in, income goes straight out to the beneficiary.
Yes. A complex trust, on the other hand, has flexibility. A complex trust is allowed to accumulate income and hold on to it if the trustee chooses. It is also permitted to make charitable contributions, and it has the power to distribute the actual principal, not just the income, to the beneficiaries.
Okay, that distinction is clear. Simple must distribute income. Complex can accumulate and can dip into principal. Now, let's talk about the final entity in this section, the estate. What happens when Aunt Agatha unfortunately passes away? There is a massive, massive exam trap here regarding the word estate.
Yes, this trips up so many candidates. When a person dies, their assets do not instantly teleport into the bank accounts of their heirs. The assets go into a temporary legal entity called an estate. The executor takes over, pays off Agatha's final debts, deals with lawyers, and prepares to transfer the wealth.
That process can take months or even years, right?
Exactly. And during that time, the estate is a living, breathing tax entity. Just like a trust, it files a Form 1041. And just like a trust, it faces those exact same compressed tax brackets, hitting 37% at $16,000 of income.
But wait, when I hear estate tax, I immediately think of a wealth transfer tax. I think of the government taking 40% of the millions of dollars Agatha's leaving behind. Are you talking about something different?
I am, and this is the trap. You have to separate the estate income tax from the estate wealth transfer tax. They are two completely different regimes.
Listener, pattern interrupt. Listen to me right now. When you see the phrase estate tax on the exam, you need to physically stop, pause, and ask yourself a question. Are they asking about the rent the estate collected this year? Or are they asking about the $20 million dragon hoard being passed down to the heirs?
Let's use an example to cement it. Aunt Agatha dies. Her prize asset is a massive luxury apartment building. It takes the executor 18 months to clear probate and legally transfer the deed of the building to Dave.
Okay.
During those 18 months, the apartment building is still full of tenants. It continues to collect $100,000 in rent every single month. That rent is new income. The estate entity has to file an income tax return form 1041 and pay estate income tax on that rent using those brutal compressed brackets unless they distribute it.
Okay, so the income the asset generates while waiting is subject to estate income tax.
Correct. Now, the actual value of the apartment building itself, let's say it is appraised at $30 million. That is the wealth being transferred. That $30 million is subject to the estate wealth transfer tax, which is filed on a completely different form, Form 706, and operates under entirely different rules, which we will cover in the final section.
Do not confuse the income the assets generate during administration with the total value of the assets themselves. That is a brilliant clarification. All right, moving on to part four, the golden years. Before we get to Agatha's final $30 million estate transfer, let's look at how Agatha and Dave manage their retirement accounts and interact with government benefits. We need to do a thorough side-by-side of retirement plan distributions, traditional versus Roth.
This is the absolute bread and butter of financial planning. Every advisor must know this cold. Let's start with the traditional side, traditional IRAs and traditional 401ks. These accounts are funded with pre-tax dollars.
Explain pre-tax practically. What does Dave actually do on his tax return?
When Dave contributes $5,000 to a traditional IRA, he gets to take a $5,000 tax deduction on his income taxes for that year. He is essentially shielding that money from the IRS right now. The IRS has not taxed that $5,000 seed money yet.
And as we know, the IRS is incredibly patient, but they always get their cut eventually.
Always. Because you got a deduction on the way in, the tax bill comes to you on the way out. When Dave reaches retirement and starts taking distributions from his traditional IRA, every single dollar he pulls out, both the original contributions and decades of investment growth, is taxed as ordinary income at his current tax bracket.
And the IRS doesn't let you just leave it in there growing tax deferred forever, do they?
No, they want their money. The IRS forces you to start taking required minimum distributions, or RMDs. Under current law, those RMDs start at age 73, or age 75 if you were born in 1960 or later. Every year, you have to calculate a specific percentage of your account balance, withdraw it, and pay taxes on it, whether you need the cash to live on or not.
Now, what if Dave gets impatient? Say Dave is 45 years old. He decides he wants a jet ski. Can he just pull the money out?
He can, but it is going to cost him. If you pull money out of a traditional retirement account before age 59 and a half, you trigger an early withdrawal penalty. You have to pay your normal ordinary income tax on the distribution, plus a 10% penalty on top of it.
Okay, let's give the listener another direct question. Let's test the math on this penalty, because you will see this calculation. Dave is 45. He pulls exactly $10,000 out of his traditional IRA to buy a jet ski. Dave's current ordinary income tax bracket from his day job is 24%. What is the total tax cost? The total amount he owes the IRS for this $10,000 withdrawal? Take a second. Reason out the two pieces.
He owes his regular tax plus the penalty.
Right. Let's break it down. Okay. First, the distribution is added to his income. So he pays a 24% ordinary income tax on the $10,000. That is $2,400. Then, because he is under 59 and a half, he gets hit with the strict 10% early withdrawal penalty. 10% of $10,000 is $1,000. You add those together. $2,400 plus $1,000 equals a total tax cost of $3,400.
He pulled out 10 grand, and the IRS kept $3,400 of it. That is a massively expensive jet ski.
There are some exceptions to that 10% penalty, right?
There are a few very specific exceptions. If you die, your heirs don't pay the penalty. If you become totally and permanently disabled, or if you use a specific amount for qualified higher education expenses or a first-time home purchase. But generally speaking, the IRS wall around that money is very high until you turn 59 and a half.
Now, contrast that with a Roth IRA. I always explain the Roth to clients as the ultimate VIP club. It is harder to get your money past the bouncers, meaning you do not get a tax deduction on the way in, you putting in after-tax dollars. But once your money's inside the club, it drinks for free forever.
That is the perfect analogy. Because you already paid income taxes on the seed money before you put it into the Roth, the IRS has already collected their primary toll. Therefore, all qualified distributions from a Roth, not just your contributions, but all of the decades of compounding investment growth, are 100% tax-free.
Just emphasize that. Dave puts in $10,000. Over 30 years, it grows into $200,000.
Yeah.
He pulls out $200,000 and pays zero taxes on $190,000 of pure growth.
Zero taxes. It is arguably the best deal in the entire tax code, but to get that tax-free treatment on the growth, the distribution must be qualified. That means the Roth account must have been open for at least 5 years, the five-year ticking clock, and Dave must be over 59 and a half, or meet one of those strict exceptions like death or disability.
And what about the forced withdrawals, the RMDs?
This is the other massive benefit. Because the IRS already taxed the seed money up front, they aren't desperate to force the money out. Roth IRAs have absolutely no lifetime required minimum distributions. You can leave the money in the account, growing tax-free, until the day you die.
Which makes the Roth IRA an absolutely incredible wealth transfer tool for estate planning, because you can pass a tax-free growing asset to your heirs.
Okay, sticking with the golden years, let's shift gears to talk about government benefits. Specifically, I want to talk about what I call the invisible taxes.
This is where financial planning gets really complex, because investment income does not exist in a vacuum. The choices an advisor makes in a client's investment portfolio can inadvertently trigger higher taxes on their Social Security or massively inflate their Medicare premiums. You pull a lever over here, and an alarm bell rings two rooms away.
Let's look at Social Security first. A lot of people think Social Security is just tax-free money from the government. It is not. The IRS uses a specific formula to determine how much of your Social Security benefit is taxable. What is that formula called? It revolves around a calculation called provisional income.
Okay, define provisional income mechanically. What goes into that blender?
To find provisional income, the IRS tells you to take your adjusted gross income, your AGI.
Let me stop you there.
Yeah.
We need to define AGI for the listener. When you fill out your Form 1040, your gross income is everything you made, your salary, your business profits, everything. But the IRS lets you take certain adjustments, like deducting student loan interest or contributions to a traditional IRA. These are called above-the-line deductions. Once you subtract those adjustments from your gross income, you arrive at your adjusted gross income, your AGI. It is a baseline metric of your wealth for the year.
Exactly. So for provisional income, you start with that AGI. Then you add back any tax-exempt interest you earn. And finally, you add 50% of your total Social Security benefit. If that final provisional income number crosses certain threshold lines, for a married couple, the first line is $32,000 and the second is $44,000, then a portion of your Social Security becomes taxable.
And if it goes really high.
If you cross the upper threshold, up to 85% of your Social Security benefit is subject to ordinary income tax.
Wait. Go back to the blender. You said you add back tax-exempt interest.
Yes, and that is a massive exam trap.
Let's paint a picture of this trap. Disastrous Dave decides he is going to manage Aunt Agatha's retirement portfolio. He looks at her investments and says, "Aunt Agatha, I'm going to save you so much money. You have all these corporate bonds that pay taxable interest. I'm going to sell them all and I'm going to buy you municipal bonds. Muni bonds are issued by local governments and the interest is 100% tax exempt at the federal level. You won't pay a dime of income tax on this interest."
And Dave is technically right about the bond interest itself. Municipal bond interest is federally tax-free, but Dave does not understand the provisional income formula. He doesn't realize that municipal bond interest must be poured back into the blender when calculating Social Security taxation.
Oh no, I see where this is going.
So Dave buys Agatha millions of dollars in municipal bonds. Her tax-exempt interest skyrockets. When her accountant does the provisional income math, that massive tax-exempt interest pushes Agatha way over the $44,000 threshold. Suddenly, because of Dave's quote-unquote tax-free strategy, 85% of Agatha's Social Security benefits are now being taxed at her highest ordinary income rate. Dave thought he was saving her tax money, but he accidentally triggered a massive invisible tax on her government benefits.
The exam writers absolutely love testing that irony. The key takeaway: tax-exempt interest is tax-free on its own, but it is not invisible to the Social Security calculation. It pushes up your provisional income. What about Medicare? How could a portfolio decision mess up a client's healthcare costs?
Medicare uses a system called IRMA. It stands for the Income-Related Monthly Adjustment Amount. Essentially, Medicare Part B, which covers doctor visits, and Part D, which covers prescription drugs, have base premiums. But if you are wealthy, the government expects you to pay more. IRMA acts as a surcharge, a penalty tax added to your monthly Medicare premiums if your income is too high.
And what income metric does Medicare use? Provisional income.
No, Medicare uses MGI, Modified Adjusted Gross Income. They take your AGI and they modify it by adding back certain things, most notably, again, your tax-exempt municipal bond interest. The government wants a true picture of your economic wealth before they subsidize your health care.
So Dave's muni bond strategy is ruining her Medicare premiums too. But what is the specific exam trap regarding IRAA?
The trap is the timeline. IRMAA is not based on what you are earning this year. It is based on your MGI from a 2-year look back.
Explain that. 2-year look back.
When Medicare is deciding what your premiums should be for the year 2026, they don't know what you are making in 2026 yet, so they look at the tax return you filed for the year 2024. Let's say Dave decides to sell a massive chunk of Agatha's highly appreciated stock in 2024 to generate cash. He triggers a huge one-time capital gain of $500,000.
So her 2024 MAGI just totally explodes.
Yes, but her Medicare premiums in 2024 don't change, and her premiums in 2025 don't change. But suddenly, in 2026, the government's computer looks back at that 2024 tax return, sees the massive capital gain, and Agatha gets a letter saying her Medicare premiums have tripled for the next 12 months.
That is a nightmare for an advisor.
Yeah.
If you don't warn a client about that, 2 years later, they are screaming at you about a healthcare bill they don't understand.
Exactly. Every time you trigger a major taxable event for an elderly client, a big capital gain, a large Roth conversion, you have to tell them, "This is going to cause an IRMA surcharge 2 years from now. It is a delayed invisible tax."
It is all connected. Okay, we've reached the grand finale, part five, wealth transfer. And Agatha finally decides it is time to pass on her dragon hoard. This brings us to the unified gift and estate tax system.
The most crucial concept to master in this entire section, the one that drives almost all estate planning logic, is the concept of basis. Specifically, how the tax basis of an asset changes depending on whether wealth is gifted while the donor is alive or inherited after the donor dies.
This goes back to our hook at the very beginning of the deep dive, the vanishing tax trick. Let's use real numbers. Let's say Aunt Agatha bought a rare piece of commercial real estate decades ago for $50,000. That $50,000 is her original protected cost basis. Today, that real estate is worth $500,000. It has $450,000 of unrealized capital gains built into it.
Okay, setting the stage.
Let's look at scenario A. Agatha decides she wants Dave to have the property right now. She formally gifts the real estate to Dave while she is still alive. What happens to the tax basis?
Gifts receive what is called carryover basis. The rule is simple. The donor's original basis carries over and becomes the recipient's basis. So Aunt Agatha's original $50,000 cost basis carries over and becomes Dave's cost basis.
So Dave now owns the property, and his basis is $50,000. He immediately turns around and sells the property to a developer for its current $500,000 market value. What is Dave's tax reality?
Dave sold it for $500,000. His basis is $50,000. Therefore, Dave personally owes capital gains tax on the $450,000 gain. The embedded tax burden did not disappear. It transferred seamlessly with the gift from Agatha to Dave.
Okay, so gifting an appreciated asset just passes the hot potato tax bill to the heir. Now let's look at scenario B. Agatha meets with a smart financial advisor. The advisor tells her, do not gift this property to Dave right now. Hold on to it.
Yep.
So Agatha holds the real estate. She does not gift it. She holds it until she dies, and she leaves the property to Dave in her will. What happens to the basis now?
Inheritances receive what is called a stepped-up basis. This is the magic mechanism. When Agatha dies, the tax code dictates that the basis of her assets automatically steps up to match the fair market value on her date of death.
So on the day she dies, the property is worth $500,000. What is Dave's new basis?
Dave inherits the property, and his completely new, legally protected cost basis is $500,000.
Let's follow the transaction. Dave inherits it. He immediately sells it to the developer for $500,000. What is his taxable gain?
Sale price of $500,000 minus a basis of $500,000 equals zero. Dave's taxable capital gain is zero. He owes absolutely no income tax on that sale.
The $450,000 of taxable gain that was hovering over that property for decades is just
legally wiped from existence.
It is legally wiped from existence. The IRS will never collect capital gains tax on that 450 grand of wealth creation. The step up in basis at death is one of the most powerful tax planning tools in the code. This is exactly why advisors constantly tell elderly clients with highly appreciated assets like stocks or real estate, do not give this to your kids while you are alive. Let them inherit it. Hold it until you die to get the step up.
Yep. Carry over for gifts. Stepped up for inheritances. That is a foundational concept.
Now, the exam writers know that you know this. So they are going to test the dark side of this rule, the exam trap. What if Agatha gifts Dave an asset that has lost value? This triggers something called the dual basis rule.
This is a very tricky, punitive rule. Let's say Agatha bought a tech stock for $100 a share. It is a disaster. It plummets and is now only worth $40 a share. She has a $60 unrealized loss. She decides to gift the stock to Dave.
Okay, let me use my new knowledge. I know gifts get a carryover basis. So Dave's basis is 100. Dave can immediately sell the stock for 40, and Dave gets to claim a $60 tax loss on his own tax return, right? Wrong. And that is exactly what the IRS is trying to prevent. The IRS will not let you transfer tax losses to another person. You cannot gift a tax deduction. So the IRS created the dual basis rule. It says that if the fair market value of the asset at the time of the gift is lower than the donor's original basis, the recipient essentially has two different bases depending on what they eventually sell it for. Crucially, for the purpose of calculating a loss, the recipient must use the lower fair market value as their basis.
Let's do the math on that. So Dave receives the stock. The fair market value on the day of the gift was $40. If Dave turns around and sells it for $30, what happens?
Because he is selling it for a loss, the IRS forces Dave to use the $40 fair market value as his basis. So he sells for $30, his basis is $40, he only gets to claim a $10 capital loss.
But wait, what happened to Aunt Agatha's original $60 loss? The difference between her $100 original buy and the $40 gift value?
It evaporated. It is gone forever. Neither Agatha nor Dave will ever get a tax benefit for that $60 loss. The IRS essentially says, Agatha, if you wanted that tax loss so badly, you should have sold the stock yourself, claimed the loss on your own tax return, and then just gifted Dave the cash. By gifting the underwater asset, you destroy the tax value.
Savage. The IRS is absolutely savage. Do not gift assets with embedded losses.
Okay, let's look at the actual transfer taxes now, the gift tax. When Agatha starts handing out cash, is she paying tax on every dollar?
The gift tax applies when you transfer property to someone without receiving full value in return. But the reality is, most everyday gifts are never actually taxed because of exclusions.
Mm-hmm.
The first layer of defense is the annual exclusion.
What is the number for that?
For 2026, the annual gift tax exclusion is $19,000 per recipient per year. You can give up to $19,000 to anyone completely tax-free, and you don't even have to report it to the IRS.
Let me ask the listener a direct question to test the limits of this exclusion. Aunt Agatha has a huge family and a lot of friends. Can Aunt Agatha give $19,000 to 100 different people this year without triggering any gift tax or using up any lifetime exemptions? Think about how the rule is phrased.
Let them reason it out.
The rule is per recipient, per year. It does not cap the donor's total output.
Right. She absolutely can. She can give $19,000 to 100 different people. That is $1.9 million transferred out of her estate completely tax-free in a single year. And if she were married, she and her husband can utilize gift splitting. That means they can combine their exclusions and give $38,000 per recipient per year.
Now, there is an exam note here about gift splitting. Do they have to file paperwork for that?
Yes. Even though no tax is owed, if a married couple uses gift splitting, they are legally required to file a gift tax return, which is Form 709, just to notify the IRS that both spouses consented to the split.
Are there any gifts that are just totally unlimited, where the $19,000 cap doesn't apply at all?
Yes, there are unlimited deductions. You can give an unlimited amount of money to your spouse, provided they are a U.S. citizen, and you can give an unlimited amount to a qualified charity with zero gift tax consequences. Furthermore, if you pay someone's medical bills or tuition directly to the institution, you write the check straight to the hospital or the university, that is an unlimited exclusion and doesn't count against your $19,000.
Okay, but what happens if Agatha wants to give Dave a cool $1 million in cash to start a new business? That is obviously way over the $19,000 annual limit. Does Agatha have to write a massive gift tax check to the IRS that year?
Not immediately. And this brings us to the core engine of wealth transfer. The Unified Lifetime Exemption. Every individual U.S. citizen is granted a massive lifetime exemption from transfer taxes. In 2026, that exemption is $15 million per person.
Okay, I want to use an analogy to explain how this mechanism works. I think of this $15 million lifetime exemption like a massive prepaid debit card for taxes that the government hands you when you are born.
I like that visualization. Let's walk through how Agatha uses the card.
Agatha wants to give Dave $1 million. The first $19,000 is covered by the annual exclusion, so she has made a taxable gift of $981,000. Instead of writing a check to the IRS for the taxes on that $981,000, Agatha reaches into her wallet, pulls out her $15 million tax debit card, and she swipes it. The IRS subtracts the $981,000 from her $15 million balance. She doesn't owe any out-of-pocket tax, but her card balance drops to roughly $14 million.
Exactly. Every time she makes a taxable gift over the annual exclusion during her life, she must file a Form 709 gift tax return, declare the gift, and the IRS docks her lifetime exemption balance. The gifts during her life slowly drain that exemption pool. And this is the crucial part. This is why it is called a unified system. Because whatever balance is left on that debit card when Agatha eventually dies is the exact amount she's allowed to use to shield her final estate from the estate tax.
Let's play that out. Over her life, she is super generous. She uses up $5 million of her exemption on massive gifts to friends. She dies. Her prepaid debit card only has $10 million left on it. Her final estate, her dragon hoard, is worth $12 million. What happens?
The executor applies her remaining $10 million exemption to the $12 million estate. The first $10 million passes to the heirs tax-free, but the remaining $2 million is unprotected. That $2 million is subject to the federal estate tax, which is a brutal flat rate of 40%.
So the estate has to write a check to the IRS for $800,000 before Dave gets his inheritance.
Spot on. Lifetime gifts and the final estate share the exact same unified pool of exemption money. You can't double dip.
There's one more exam trap in this wealth transfer section, and it involves married couples. It's a concept called portability. What is portability mechanically?
Portability allows a married couple to share their exemptions. Let's say a husband and wife each have a $15 million exemption. The husband dies first. He leaves everything to his wife. Because of the unlimited marital deduction, his estate pays zero tax, and he doesn't use any of his $15 million exemption. Portability allows the surviving wife to inherit her dead husband's unused $15 million exemption. She adds it to her own $15 million, meaning she can now shield up to $30 million when she eventually dies. It's called the Deceased Spouse's Unused Exemption, or DSUE.
So the $15 million just automatically rolls over to the widow's account.
I know. That is the massive exam trap. Portability is not automatic.
What does the executor have to do?
To claim portability, the executor of the deceased husband's estate must file a formal estate tax return form 706. They must file this form even if the husband's estate was small and no tax was owed. The form acts as the official notification to the IRS that the wife is claiming the rollover. If the executor forgets to file form 706 within the deadline, the husband's $15 million exemption evaporates. The wife loses it completely.
The IRS loves their paperwork. No form 706, no portability. The exemption just dies with the spouse.
Yeah.
We have covered a massive, sprawling amount of ground today. From day trading limits to shoelace company phantom income to trust cliffs and dragon hordes. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the top testable takeaways from this entire unit. I want to synthesize the mechanisms we learned. I'll start. We'll trade off. Number one, cost basis is your protected seed money. Net capital losses offset gains infinitely. But the firewall protects the national tax base, meaning you can only deduct a maximum of $3,000 against your ordinary W-2 income per year. The rest carries forward.
Number two, the wash sale rule prevents fake tax harvesting. It creates a 61-day window. If you trigger it in a taxable account, the loss defers to the new basis. But the trap, if you buy the replacement stock in an IRA, the loss is permanently disallowed because IRAs don't track capital basis.
Number three, C corporations are artificial people that face double taxation, the toll road analogy. S-Corp partnerships and LLCs remove the corporate toll booth and pass the income directly through to the owners. LLCs are chameleons that must elect their tax status.
Number four, the phantom income trap. Pass-through income reported on a Schedule K-1 is taxable to the owner in the year it is earned, regardless of whether the business actually distributed any cash to them to pay the bill.
Number five, income investments. REIT dividends do not get the VIP qualified discount. They are taxed as ordinary income because the REIT paid no corporate tax. MLP distributions are generally treated as a return of your original capital, which reduces your cost basis.
Number six, the untouchables. Trusts and estates face aggressively compressed tax brackets, hitting the maximum 37% rate at just over $16,000 of income. This prevents wealthy individuals from using them as tax shelters. To avoid the cliff, trusts distribute income to beneficiaries to use their lower human tax rates.
Number seven, the vanishing tax trick. Inherited assets get a step up in basis to the fair market value at the date of death, wiping out embedded capital gains. Gifted assets get a carryover basis, transferring the tax burden to the recipient. But remember the dual basis rule. You cannot gift a tax loss.
And number eight, the wealth transfer engine. The unified lifetime exemption is $15 million per person in 2026. It is a shared prepaid debit card pool between your lifetime taxable gifts and your final estate transfer. And portability for a surviving spouse requires filing Form 706 to claim the rollover.
Beautifully synthesized. Before we sign off, you always have a way of looking at these rigid rules and finding a deeper, almost philosophical angle on how this impacts the real world. What is the provocative thought you want to leave the listener with today?
It revolves around that final point, the $15 million lifetime exemption. Recent legislation made that massive $15 million exemption permanent. There is no sunsetting clause anymore. It will just continue to index upward for inflation every year.
Okay, so the threshold for paying the estate tax is staying incredibly high.
Right. Now, think about the downstream consequences of that. If you are a financial advisor dealing with a wealthy, successful client, say they are a doctor and their total lifetime estate is worth $8 million. To normal people, that is incredibly rich. But under the law, the federal estate tax is essentially dead to them. They will never cross the $15 million line, let alone a $30 million married line. So ask yourself, how does that change the fundamental philosophy of financial planning? For the last 50 years, high-end estate planning was almost entirely driven by the singular goal of dodging the estate tax. Setting up incredibly complex trusts, shuffling assets around, finding weird loopholes just to avoid that 40% hit. If wealth transfer is no longer about dodging the estate tax for 99% of your wealthy clients, what is it about now?
That is fascinating. If the tax boogeyman is gone, what drives the planning?
Exactly. Is the focus now entirely on asset protection, building fortresses around the money to protect it from malpractice lawsuits or a child's messy divorce? Or is it about behavioral control? controlling heirs from the grave, setting up strict trust rules so someone like Disastrous Dave doesn't inherit $2 million and instantly blow it on a fleet of jet skis. Think about how the permanence of this one massive tax exemption completely reshapes why legal structures are built and how you have to frame estate planning to your clients. It is no longer just a math and tax game, it is now a legacy and control game.
That is a brilliant reframe. The tax tail isn't wagging the dog anymore. The client's actual human goals have to take center stage. Well, that brings us back to where we started. The tax code is not just clean precision engineering on a spreadsheet. It is a muddy, complicated landscape of behavioral nudges, historical compromises, and IRS firewalls. But once you understand the why behind the rules, whether it's the $3,000 loss limit protecting the tax base or the step-up in basis wiping out gains, you aren't just memorizing flashcards anymore. You are actually learning how to see the matrix. Good luck on your Series 66 exam. You've got this. Keep unpacking the why, and we will see you on the next deep dive.